Hey, everyone, and welcome to another episode of React Native Radio. I'm your panelist for today, Josh Justice. And today we have a special guest, Yasser Harchani. Say hello.
Hey, everyone. My name is Yasser Harchani.
Yasser, why don't you tell us a bit about yourself and why you're famous and how you've gotten into React Native?
Yeah, sure. So my name is Yasser Harchani. I'm from Casablanca, 21 years old. I'm not that famous. I don't have many followers in Twitter or something, but I love writing about things I learned. And the last one is the introduction in React Native Navigation by Wix, which brings me here with you.
When I'm building a new product, G2i is the company that I call on to help me find a developer who can build the first version. G2i is a hiring platform run by engineers that matches you with React, React Native, GraphQL, and mobile engineers who you can trust. Whether you are a new company building your first product or an established company that wants additional engineering help, G2i has the talent you need to accomplish your goals. Go to devchat.tv/G2i to learn more about what G2i has to offer. In my experience, G2i is linked up with experienced developers that can fit my budget, and the G2i staff are friendly and easy to work with. They know how product development works and can help you find the perfect engineer for your stack. Go to devchat.tv/G2i to learn more about G2i.
Great. And I know you shared a number of other topics that you might want to get into about kind of getting into React Native for the first time. And all of those sound really great. Yeah. One quick intro question. I'm curious, what was your background before working in React Native? Were you a JavaScript developer or native, or was it your first development experience?
My first development experience was Ruby on Rails. That's outside the university or outside school. So yeah, I was learning Ruby and Ruby on Rails. I make an article about it, if you saw my articles about making slow URLs. Anyway, then I the React was like famous here in Morocco. It was a lot of good opportunities in React. That's why I started to learn React. Then I got this internship with React Native, and this is how I began my journey with React Native.
Very cool. So yeah, do you want to talk about your article about React Native navigation first or something else?
Yeah, sure. I'm going to talk about the React Native navigation. Then we can discuss the point that I made in the web doc. Okay.
Cool. Yeah. Why don't you just kind of summarize the article or kind of get into what you want to share from that article?
Yeah. The first reason why I watched the article is because I see a lack of articles and tutorials about React Native navigation, as it's the second famous one. The first one is React Navigation. It's really popular, have a great tutorial articles, you can name that. But for React Native navigation, it had a poor documentation, that's first. And the second thing is not many tutorials that will guide you in. So that's why I decided to write an article about my experience with it and the things I learned from it. And that's it. It was like great experience to write about what I learned. So the reason why I chose React, not me, but the company chose React Native Navigation, is because it's a native solution for the navigation. That's the main thing that why we chose the React Native Navigation. We already switched from React Navigation in some projects to the React Native Navigation because lack of performance. As React Navigation don't use any native side, it's just JavaScript, so it puts a lot of screens above others, which cause some performance issues. And also the React Native Navigation have this feeling of you're using a native app, so it's really important for us to give the user the feeling that they are interacting with native apps. So yeah, that's the reason why I choose and the company choose a React Native navigation.
If you can share, what is the company you're interning with, and what are the apps that you're working on? What do they do?
Actually, I'm not interning with this company right now. I started React Native as an intern, and I switched the company to this one, which is called Orange Bytes, which is a company for building great applications. We have many great projects that we did in the past years. And That's it.
So the app that you're using React Native Navigation with, what was it? What was it used for? And was it iOS or Android or both?
No, both. The app we are using are in production right now in Android. We're still waiting for the Apple review to be done. Yeah, it's a nightmare with Apple, but yeah, that's, we can get with it. Anyway, the app is like a social media app, social media app like Reddit, Facebook, and other stuff. Yeah, and the other one is another application which is already in production called Burmage. Burmage, it's a platform for learning programming languages and development in Arabic. So the mobile application is built with React Native and the React Native Navigation.
Cool. I'm curious. I know that when I first started in React Native, we had gotten through the days when there was like half a dozen or more navigation libraries. And the community had kind of settled on React Navigation, which is the JavaScript implementation, and React Native Navigation, which you mentioned, which hooks into the iOS and Android navigation code, respectively. And I feel like in the last year, things have drifted more towards the community, like in the React Native docs, really promoting React Navigation as the default choice. Nothing against React Native Navigation, but I felt like a year ago it was more split, and now I'm hearing more and more about the JavaScript library. And I know that they're focusing on performance to make it as good as they can, given that it does live in the JavaScript layer. So yeah, that's interesting to hear that y'all ran across the performance limitations, and just the benefits you get from going fully native on the React Native Navigation side. That makes sense.
Yeah. Also, I want to mention that the React Navigation community in general are making good progress, to be honest. They have this alpha version. We are using it in all bytes. We are using the alpha version, the last version of React Navigation. And actually, it's quite good with the performance issue and other stuff because it uses more native side right now, as it in the installation guide, it guides you for linking other libraries that use native, like maybe React Native Gesture Handler or something like that. I don't remember, but yeah, the progress that React Navigation is making, I believe that if they continue like this, they will beat React Native Navigation in performance, and it will be much easier for users to use the React Navigation over React Native Navigation.
That relates to a question I was going to ask. As y'all started to integrate React Native Navigation into your project, did you find that you had to work with a lot of Java and Objective-C code that was unfamiliar, or was it pretty straightforward to drop it in and you were good to go to mostly work in JavaScript yourself?
To be honest, the documentation was quite good for starting. Yeah, just straightforward, copy the code and paste it into the into your code. And yeah, here you go. Yeah, it's really straightforward. And it's even easier right now with the auto-linking that React Native provides within in the last releases.
Looking through your blog post, it makes sense just the value that it's adding. I really like step-by-step tutorials as well. And so like when I write tutorials, they kind of reflect the style that you have here. So I like it a lot. I think the thing for me is oftentimes when I'm checking out an open source library, I want to see if I want to use it. I want to evaluate it to see if it's going to be good for me. And so if I have to like figure out the details of how to put it in place, that means that raises the barrier to me trying it out. And so I love blog posts like yours where it's like, hey, let me just, I can just walk through it. I can give it a try. I can get a feel for it. And then I can say like, that'll bring up the questions in my mind to decide if it's a good library for me or not. Do you find yourself looking for tutorials like that? Is that your mental process as well?
Yeah. I really like the tutorials that really break the technology to you and just straightforward and basic steps until you reach the higher level of the technology. So basically, for me, when I started the React Native journey, I didn't know a lot of things about navigation. I didn't know the native side of navigation. I needed to use both platforms to know how users feel while using a native app. And I tried that in the React Native Navigation, because in the React Native Navigation, you can use a push or model or a lot of different navigation options. So yeah, it's really important to understand the platform first, then use it in your navigation solution.
That makes sense that going with React Native Navigation would kind of force you that way. Because it's hooking into native, you're not going to accidentally use the iOS approach on Android or vice versa, like would be an option if you're in the JavaScript layer.
Yeah, yeah.
What else do you want to discuss about your navigation post?
Yeah, sure. Do you want me to guide you through it?
Sure, yeah. Why don't you kind of walk us through it, sort of a high level of the different pieces that you build?
So first of all, I ask a question, why you should use React Native Navigation. And basically, the React Native docs answers this question. And it tells that the React Native Navigation provides native navigation in both Android and iOS. And that's exactly what everyone is looking for in native solution. Then I just getting started with the React Native Navigation. The installation guides are pretty straightforward, and it's even easier with the last releases. Then I try in my projects to simplify the navigation and have a structure that will make sense. So that's in the article, you will see how I separate the navigation logic from the screens, etc. So whenever you want, let's say, pushing a screen, registering the screens, in the React Navigation have just one wrapper, just one screen, and they push screen over others. For the React Native Navigation, every screen have its own wrapper. So you don't push screen over others like React Navigation. You have your own screen, your own screen, and when you dismiss this screen, it will be deleted from the view. So no performance issue in that. That's some main difference between the React Navigation and the React Native Navigation. Yeah, then we played with the push and the open model options in React Native Navigation. How the model have some other options, like we want it from to be fade or from bottom to top, etc. You can style the top bars, how to dismiss and create your own dismiss button in the top bar, etc. Or if you want to use the native solution, which is provided by default in the React Native Navigation. Yeah, etc. Also the push screen iOS feel really native, because you can swipe if you want to return back to the other screen, which is really, really good. I use it a lot.
Yeah. That's cool. That's the kind of detail that, because I'm not very user interface minded, I don't notice that like when I'm building my app, but I might notice it like after I'm using my app, it's like, oh, I can't swipe to go back in the navigation. Like I would have, I didn't think about the fact that I usually do that, but apparently I usually do that a lot day to day. So yeah. I have to discover these things as I go myself.
Yeah.
Cool. What else in the article?
Yeah, that's it. When to use a model? It's a really good question. Like models are used when the user's immediate attention is required, as it prevents them from interacting with views beneath it. This is from the article, but what it means is, if you want to focus the user in one part or not particular action, and you don't want them to access any other screens or to navigate more in the app, like payment, an example. For that, it's highly recommended to use a model over push-it screen. Okay, because the model will just keep them in that screen until they finish, and you can dismiss the model and they will continue navigating in the app. So that's one different use case between model and push-it screen.
No, that's interesting. In a hobby project that I'm doing, I just ran across trying to put in modal functionality just a day or two ago. And I was looking at the different options. There's a modal built into React Native, And I'm using React Native Paper that also has modal functionality. But if I'm remembering right, all of them work differently. And you know, React Navigation also has modal. And so each of them works slightly differently. If I remember right, the modal that's built into React Native just instantaneously appears, just kind of shows up and covers the screen. The one that was built into React Native Paper is actually doesn't fully cover the screen. So it acts more like what you'd expect on the web, where the modal is just kind of in the middle and the rest of the screen is grayed out. You can tap outside of it to escape the modal. I'm not sure if that falls into like material design guidelines or not, because that's something I haven't dug into too much. And then React Navigation had, as I can see in the GIF in your article here, with the animation that happens for React Native Navigation, React Navigation worked the same way as well. So I was kind of playing around with the different options there. But yeah, what you're showing that the navigation library provides is definitely what's most familiar for me using iOS apps.
Yeah, that's true. And I don't actually think that in the iOS last releases, you can dismiss the module by swiping from top to down to bottom. So I'm not sure if React Native Navigation support that or not, but I really hope they do, because it's an awesome feature to be added.
Yeah, I've noticed a few apps that I use on my iPhone. I've got an iPhone. I've noticed, I think in particular in iOS 13, places where something modal-ish comes up from the bottom, but it doesn't look like, it doesn't go up to the navigation bar. And so it looks like something, maybe even with just like rounded corners at the top, it visually looks like something that you can slide back down. Yeah. And so I'm not sure if that's like a user interface widget that's built into iOS, or if it's just these individual apps that have added it. I think some of them are Apple apps, actually, but that doesn't mean it's a functionality that's available for everyone. But regardless, that's a pattern that seems to be emphasized in iOS 13. And so it would be great if navigation libraries could provide it as well.
And support it, because it's really good. And I use it all the time when using iOS apps. So yeah, it would be really good to add this functionality to our apps.
Talking about the kind of the features that the OS provides reminds me of some of the other kind of discussion points you shared. Do you want to move on from the blog post now and talk about your other points about getting into React Native development?
Yeah, sure. Okay, my first point is before you start using React Native. So most of the developers come to React Native from the web and have experience with React. Okay, so when For those who will come to the React Native in the future, I just want to guide them to the differences that they will face while using React Native. So the first difference is the base components. So React Native is quite different from the web. So in the web, you can use tags like p and paragraphs and divs and et cetera. For React Native, it uses its own base components. Like for the paragraph, we use a tag called checks. For the div, we use view, etc. So these differences, it's not that hard to pick up. By the time you will find it easier to pick instead of Googling it every time. And yeah, also the React Native comes with a set of built-in components that can be used during the UI elements, etc. Like the checks and view that we just talked about. The second thing is styling. Styling isn't done with CSS in React Native. So, however, the syntax is quite similar. In React Native, we use the camel case instead of the dash, I guess. And we use, to apply styles in React Native, we use style sheet. Style sheet only is create and apply to a component style each attributes. The naming is also different. There are so many features that are missing from the React Native styles that you can find in CSS. But to be honest, styling in React Native, it's really easy because it's use Flexbox and you don't have to bother yourself with all these screen dimensions, etc. If you have iPad, you are in trouble. But beside that, you are really good to go. So that's the second thing.
One note on that point, the project I'm using that I'm building at work is using the styled components library for React Native. And that's very interesting because You know, Styled Components is a library that works on the web as well, but it also works on React Native. And when you're using that with React Native, these style sheets that you write look a lot more like the web. For example, even just pulling up their documentation here, they have background color that does use a hyphen, a dash, instead of camel casing. And so I haven't been as involved in the styling myself on this project. I've been more at the infrastructure and testing layer. But it's interesting, like using styled components for React Native might be more familiar, but it also might, I'm not sure, it might cause more stumbling blocks for folks because folks might assume that things work just like the web because it looks just like the web. And yet maybe some things are different. And so I think it definitely makes sense for folks to, who are new to React Native, certainly get used to the built-in styling functionality because that's what's going on under the hood. But styled components is an option if you want something a bit more familiar. Have you tried styled components yourself?
No. I never tried styled components. I just dig right into the style sheet. Yeah, but it's really a good option for folks that are coming from the web and already use it, styled components. It's really good for them to start with. I highly recommend everyone who uses styled components use it in React Native because it's really going to be easier for you instead of bothering yourself with reading the style sheet documentation. So yeah, that's really good option.
Cool. Well, I think what other topics do you want to get into for recommendations for new developers?
Yeah, for new developers, I just want to say that the navigation is not that big issue that you're going to face. It's a kind of issue, but not that big. So you just need to choose between the React navigation and the React Native navigation. They are both good. They are both have great community behind them. And just pick the easiest one for you and one you will find yourself enjoying working with it. For me, the React Native navigation is the right one because it uses the native side. For the React navigation, it's really progressing in a good way. So I highly recommend people to use them both and choose the right one for them.
And if I remember right, if you're using Expo for your app instead of the React Native CLI, I think React Navigation is built in and it's available for you out of the box. As well as because you don't have access to the native code layer, yes. React Native Navigation wouldn't be an option there. So if you're using Expo for learning or that's what your project is in, then React Navigation is provided for you out of the box and it's a good option.
I agree with you on that point.
You mentioned upgrades as something that was a learning point for you.
Yeah. I'm going to talk now about upgrades. So sometimes upgrading React Native can cause a world of pain. From my experience, upgrading some React Native projects, I had learned some best practices that can make the upgrade go smooth, especially for the projects that are older than 0.6. So the first tips is use the React Native upgrade helper. This tool aims to provide the full set of changes between any two versions, so you have an idea on what changes you need to do in your code. This one is really, really important. It's really important. I highly recommend using the React Native upgrade helper. The second one is checking your node modules. I learned this the hard way. Always check your modules and also check read the change log to see if there is any API changes you need to make. I learned this with dealing with Sentry. Sentry had changes its API, I guess, from 0.59. It was really a nightmare because the app crashes in production. I didn't read the change log. So it was really a mess for me. So yeah, remember to read the change log and see if there's any breaking changes you need to make. The third one, it's like a personal opinion. I like to do the upgrade manually. You have two options. The first one is use the React Native client to upgrade your project. The second one, which I feel confident doing that, it's manually. When you do the upgrade manually, you have a better idea of what is going on while upgrading. So you will know the problem if you face it. You know where the problem comes from if you face it in error. So that's a good tip from my personal experience. And Another thing is when you want to upgrade the React Native, just make sure to not upgrade immediately after React Native team release the major release. Just because if you are using a production app and there is like a big team in it and other stuff, you just need to be more patient until the team of React Native fix some bugs and do improvements to the release. Because you don't want to be the first one who come to an error and try to figure it out, especially if you are not a native developer and you are JavaScript developer. If you face an error in the native side after upgrading with no other help in the community, that will be really hard for you to fix. So just keep in mind, don't upgrade after each release. Just keep it up until the bug fixes and improvements. Yeah, that's the upgrade tips.
Yeah.
Infinite Red is a US-based consultancy specializing in React and React Native. They do mobile app and web design and development. They are deeply involved in the React and React Native open source communities, publish the React Native newsletter with 10,000 subscribers, and are involved with the React Native core development. If you have a project and need design or engineering help from an experienced team to take it all the way from concept to completion, get in touch with Infinite Red. Also check out Chain React, the React Native conference, which is hosted by Infinite Red in July in Portland with 500 developers from all around the world. You can find them at infinite.red. Make sure to mention you heard about them in this ad.
Speaking of the idea of doing upgrades manually, something that I in my development in general, I like to move in small steps. And when it comes to upgrading dependencies, it's definitely the same way. So on my projects, I'll find myself, maybe I'll upgrade like third-party dependencies first to their latest versions. And then when I upgrade React Native or another framework that I'm using, that way they're all set and ready for the latest version. Or if I find that something will conflict, I'll like roll it back. And I might do like separate pull requests for each dependency upgrade. And that way I can run my test suite on it. And that way I can really narrow it down to see, okay, when I upgraded this one library, here's what things went wrong. Let me roll that back. And maybe I'll talking about like giving things time to shake out. Maybe I'll leave that library at an older version for a little while and wait and see. Maybe there's, you know, in the React Native community, usually I'll find a GitHub issue with the error that I'm seeing. Somebody else has already reported it. So I'll just bookmark that, watch it, you know, keep an eye on it, and I'll kind of move on from there. So I've definitely, in all my front-end projects, I've definitely found that like, you know, yeah, upgrading one little bit, one little dependency at a time works best for me.
And you just mentioned in good tips also, just commit whenever you make a change. So you can roll back to the last working history. So yeah, that's really good tip to add.
Yeah, it's useful for your own code as well to be able to get back to a stable point. But certainly when you're working with these dependencies and it's not code that you're familiar with, that you may be limited in your ability to troubleshoot. I know I sure am. I definitely want to find those safe points where it's like, it's working right now, let me commit it. And I'll definitely get in situations where I forget to do that. And I do a bunch of work because I think it'll go smoothly and then it doesn't work out. And so I'll say, you know what, let me start over. And this time I'm going to make those small commits and it works out better that way.
It's really good also in the long term, because one day I remember I had like an issue that was happening like really back then. I think more than a week ago, I made the mistake and break something else. So hopefully I commit every now and then. So I just split it or divided the commit history by two and start checking out where is the problem comes from. Then I check out this one commit message, which was like a small commit message with small changes. And then I knew what I did wrong. So it's really important to comment on every change.
Yeah, I think when I'm doing code review for others, that's helpful. When I'm looking back to see what happened, or it can be helpful. I think especially in cases where there's changes at a few different spots throughout the code base. Maybe upgrading a library will make a change to your Android project or your iOS project that you don't touch every day. It's usually abstracted away and React Native handles it. And yet you see there was a change to your build.gradle file. And so it's nice to know when I upgrade like 10 different dependencies and there's a bunch of different changes to the Gradle file to see which change came from which library. So that if something is, you know, airing out at the lower level, like which one of these introduced this dependency? So it's, you know, the more you can understand your code, the better. And we don't perfectly understand it. It's not like we need to be perfect, but you know, having that nice good Git history helps you out, helps you to be able to go back to track down what happened and why. So I think we're saying the same thing, but I'm just getting more and more excited about the idea of small commits as we talk.
Yeah, that's for sure.
How about the topic of user experience? What have you found that is helpful for new React Native developers to know?
Okay, for the user experience, when both, like most of us, are coming from the web to the mobile development, there is some stuff that we need to encounter while developing our app. The first one is you need to configure your checks inputs. You are expecting the user to, if you are expecting the user to enter a value, a numeric value, you should use the proper keyboard type, which is numeric. The same thing happened for the email and password. In the case of multiple fields, make sure that the return button will focus the next field. And at the end, it will focus the button that will submit the form, for example. Okay, then also use a placeholder, just like the web. Give the user some extra example of expected data format. Also, talking about keyboards, while using keyboards or styling the screens, which is full of the text inputs, etc., just make sure to manage the layout when the keyboard is visible. This tip is really it's really good because the software keyboard takes almost half of the screen, which is can cover some interactive elements. In Android, from the platform of Android, you can dismiss the keyboard if you tap outside or outside the keyboard in the screen, for example, or you can just tap the back hardware button that's in the top. That's in the bottom of the hardware buttons. But in the iOS, it's a different thing. In the iOS, you need to specify how the layout will appear, because there is no hardware back button for the user to tap. So it's really, you can use the keyboard of reading view component to work around that, but it's not always working. In some cases, we had some issues with it. I don't know if you, Josh, have experienced this or not with the keyboard avoiding view. Did you ever experience an issue with it?
The apps I've worked on haven't needed to worry about that too much. My client app right now is a tablet app, and there's plenty of space for the software keyboard to pop up. Tell me more about how you're able to work around those problems.
Working around this problem, I use one library. I don't even remember its name, but it's really good. I'm going to provide it after this. Working with that library gave us more help dealing with the keyboard appearance. Because it's really a nightmare. When the keyboard appears, you need to move all the UI to top. So that's really difficult using the keyboard avoiding view. Because let's get to some detail. The keyboard avoiding view is expecting some elements to be to the bottom of the screen in order to push it on the top. So if you don't have some elements that's in the bottom, they will be hidden with the keyboard. So, but using that library just made things easier for us. The next thing in the user experience is make click areas bigger. Your users don't use mouses, they use their fingers, and especially the thumb for scrolling and clicking buttons. So just make sure to use the standard of 44 pixel width and height in every button you have, as mentioned in the human interface guidelines by Apple. To achieve this, you can use several props or styles, like the mean height and the mean width in the style sheet, or you can use the head slope prop in the view. Do you have any experience with that, Josh? Like, do you ever encounter how the user is going to click the buttons or something like that?
Yeah? You say that one more time, what the specific prop you were describing?
Yeah, the specific prop is the heat slope. Heat slope, you give it the height, or not the height, the space that you want from the button to be clickable. Just you can tell heat slope to be 10 pixels from the top and 10 pixels from the left, bottom, and right. And the buttons will be clickable from those space that you give it.
Yeah, I haven't used it myself, but the idea, I remember early in the iOS days, when I did some native iOS development, that whole, I was familiar with the 44 pixels, the idea of like, hey, this is not a desktop machine, like 44 pixels is as small as you could get. And sometimes I feel that Apple themselves did not follow that in all of their apps, and things sort of changed. But the hit slop is a great option where visually you want to not have a button look so large and take up so much space. So you want to de-emphasize it, but you still want it to be just as tappable. And I actually just deleted a game on my phone yesterday where the tapping was not accurate. And so I was issuing the wrong commands. I was like, this is pretty infuriating, actually. And same thing if your bank app, if you're tapping the wrong thing, that would be very bad. And it's interesting. It's kind of surprising to think about the fact that, you know, that it would be intuitive to a user that's like, oh, I see this small button and yet I tap on it. And the fact that the hit slop area is bigger, that feels intuitive. Like when you sit and think about it, it doesn't necessarily make sense. But I know for people that know more about UIs than me and are better at it, like our designers where I work, just the fact that psychology of it is very important, and you want to have that feel to be intuitive and not just say, oh, yes, technically, if I'm really paying attention, I can get the tap in and that's good enough. Like, that's not good enough for a user experience.
Yeah, I certainly agree. Next thing I want to mention is use native feedback. Talking about click areas, each platform has its own feedback behavior. In Android, users are used on the ripple effect as a visual confirmation so that they will know the touch or the click was successful. The ripple effect, I don't know if you know it, it's when there is like a circle outside the button that's highlighted with some color that you specified. So that's the Android users are really used to it. For iOS users, the feedback, it's the highlight and the opacity effect. So to integrate this in your app, you have two options. The first option is to do it like to hard code it. Use platform to selectively apply components for each platform. And you can use the touchable native feedback on Android, but the trick is it's only working on the Android API above 21. So it's really challenging for you to write all that yourself. The option two, it's using the library called React Native Platform Touchable to handle that for you. And that's my favorite option.
That makes sense. When I thought about the platform specific components that are made available by React Native, it's interesting because in some senses, because I'm not, you know, the most UI minded person, in some senses I'm like, hey, just give me a button and just make it do what a button should do, and that would be the best. And so it's like, I like that. I actually reach for higher level UI libraries like React Native Paper and React Native Elements on my personal projects. And yet for our client-facing project, we've custom coded it. But that one is Android only. And so we don't have, I'm not working in the custom coding across platform functionality. But it certainly makes sense to have the ability to say, it's like, hey, like we're building for these native platforms. We need the control to get to that lower level to say, okay, I want touchable native feedback on Android and I want to do something different on iOS. So yeah, I think, React Native itself and the community creating these different levels of abstraction. So you could dive in at just the level you want to. You can get that granular control if you need it, or you can go with a higher level of abstraction like I tend to reach for. It's nice to have the whole range of options, you know?
Yeah, I totally agree with you. The next thing is the safe area view. When dealing with big size devices in iOS, like above 850 pixels height, you will need to render the contents inside the safe boundaries of the device. So to use that, you can use the safe area view from the React Native team. So it's great. It's a built component that can wrap your app, and you can do a lot of things with it. You can specify the color, which is going to be affected to the status bar, I guess. And one note to keep in mind is that if your app is supporting orientation, you need to add the safe area view into the content that will be outside the safe area view. So that's a good tip to keep in your mind while developing your components.
Yeah, I love that safe area view is made available and we can use it. I love that it's in the default template when you create a new React Native app with React Native CLI now. It's like, it's there, it's set up for you. And so that default is, it lets everybody know about it. So you can just, I'm always, whenever I'm creating a new hobby project or tutorial project, I just take that default project, delete out what's inside the safe area view, but having that, having the status bar component, it's just a nice template to start from.
Yeah, yeah. Also, you can use some couple area safe area views in the same screen. So you will have some color in the outside the boundaries on the top, and another color in the bottom boundaries. So yeah, it's really cool how you can use it. React Native detects if it's in the top or in the bottom. You can just use it as a view, which will not cause any trouble. So yeah, it's a really good component to use.
These are all really great user experience tips. And I could see myself not running across these for a while. Like, hey, I just start building my app. It works well enough. And so I'm good. So how did you find out about all these tips? Was it through research? Did users complain? Like, how did you find out about these?
No. Actually, for those tips, I just, when using my Android or iOS, I just find this tricky feedbacks that I have from different apps. So I say, oh, this is a pattern in every app. So why it's not in my app? Let's implement this. Let's search about this. What is the ripple effect? I didn't know what is the ripple effect until I think I read the React Native gesture handler, I guess. They have some ripple effect options too. So I the first time I used that library to do it, but the React Native touchable was a lot easier. And that's why I use it. So yeah, just having this all native behaviors from every app I use, I just ask myself, if this is the native feedback, why it's not in my app that I'm developing? I should definitely use it. And that's why I search about these things and try to use them in my app. Also, there is a good article in the React Native site in the blog, which is the user experience, I guess, something like that. User experience in React Native, how to make good user experience. So yeah, there are a lot of tips that are already there. So check it out. It's really good.
Great. Thanks for that link. I haven't read that post before. Yeah. That'll be in the show notes for the listeners.
Yeah, good. Okay. Next, tell me, do you ever encounter some user experience that you just saw in some app and you were curious for adding it to your app?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, it's happened all the time. Okay, the next thing is built for both platforms. So this is not user experience, this is developer experience. Built for both platforms. In case you want to make your life miserable, just ignore this step. So while developing, there will be some differences between the platform styling, positioning, text size, etc. Also, the animation can behave differently. So just make sure to test on both platforms frequently. That's a good tip that you need to encounter while developing, because it's going to save you a lot of time.
So. Yeah, this is tension in this area, because I've heard some folks definitely share this tip that you said. I've heard other folks say, hey, like, we know we're going to release for both platforms and we're going to build with React Native so that we can, but we're going to stagger the releases. We're only going to release for one platform first and then a few months later release for the other. And what that allows the developers to do is to push off some of this. Like, I don't have to test for both platforms as I go. And so that could save you some time. And yet it could also bite you in the end, where it's like you're kind of saving all of the working for the other platform for the very end. So Yeah, I could see definitely an argument to say, hey, you know what? Like, I mean, yeah, probably if you're building for both platforms as you go, probably it makes sense to release for pretty soon. But yeah, like, you know, figuring those things out as you go, you can avoid you digging into a hole.
Yeah, especially I use the same approach that this guy said. I just developed the Android version first. And you know what? I really waste a lot of time to make the iOS the same as Android. It was really painful. All these screens that you need to change, all this style that you need to make, just painful to the hack. Just make sure to test on both platforms, and trust me, it will save you a lot of time.
Really makes you appreciate, if for our listeners who are web developers like we are, it makes you appreciate just how far browser compatibility has come. Unfortunately, not everybody tests in Firefox, and so not everything works perfect there. But I'll say I've been a web developer for 15 years, and things were way worse back in the day. And so just how consistent we are, how much we can rely on the DOM and the box model working consistently across browsers, it is really, really nice. And it just draws home the fact that as much as React Native is allowing us to build using the same technology for iOS and for Android, like, it's really different platforms and it's different native components that are underneath the hood that have differences. I don't think it's a fault of React Native that there are these differences there. I think that for the architecture that React Native has chosen, where unlike Flutter, for example, we really are going down to those native widgets, it makes sense to allow them to behave the way they are.
Yeah.
And so this is just the downside to get access to the fact that a button is really a button. A text input is really a native text input. This is the cost we experience by having some of these inconsistencies and just needing to decide what's the right thing to do in this case to get the iOS version and the Android version of my app behaving the way users of that platform would expect.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Also, in React Native, the developer experience is not that good if you are coming from the web. Developer experience is really bad. I guess it's progressing very well because, like, this hot, the new hot reload and the other debugging tools that the React Native is working on, that's going to make life more easier for React Native developers. But beside that, yeah, you're going to really need sometimes you're going to need some native developer beside you to tell you what's wrong, because debugging in React Native is not that good. Just this to be keep it in your mind. Sometimes you're going to, I don't know, face a crash with no error. That's happened to me with Android. Just crash with no error, then I should, first time I opened the Android Studio and figure out where the logs in and just read the logs to the chart and figure out what was the error. I think that's, for me, it's a lot of fun, to be honest. I really like to do that because it's unexplored territories for me. So doing that just made me more confident that I can learn anything and I can deal with the differences in both platforms. I don't know about you, Josh, but that's how I feel when I face something like this errors, this native errors.
Yeah, I think I do as well. And I think that's a really great insight into who is a good fit for React Native at this stage of its maturity. If you're someone that wants to have all the answers spelled out for you, it's like, hey, like, I've read a book and I know exactly when this error happens, here's exactly what's going on. React Native is maybe not the best bet. Like, I think using straight up native development or straight up web development is going to be smoother there. Whereas if you're someone that wants to explore, that kind of wants to dig in and learn more, it doesn't mean you need to become an iOS or an Android expert. But if you're someone who's excited by and motivated by, just like you just said, digging in and understanding more, that's going to mean that React Native is an enjoyable experience for you. Whereas if that's a constant drain whenever that happens, maybe there's another platform you prefer to work on instead. So yeah, I think that's a great insight.
Yeah.
Hey folks, this is Charles Maxwood, and I just launched my book, The Max Coder's Guide to Finding Your Dream Developer Job. It's up on Amazon. We self-published it. I would love your support. If you want to go check it out, you can find it there, The Max Coder's Guide to Finding Your Dream Developer Job. Have a good one. Max out.
Also, the next step I want to talk about is always, from time to time, test on a physical device if you don't have, like, some others that do that for you. So make sure to test on a physical device, because in some cases you will find some errors and crashes, performance issues maybe, in the physical device that will not be shown on the emulator. And that's happened all the time. So just make sure to, from time to time, test on the physical device. I don't know about you, George, but for me, I faced some crashes that did not appear in the emulator at all. And still experience some issues in the native, in the physical device, especially in Android, from a device to device. It's really challenging to figure out where the problem is.
So for our client app, we have a sort of, there's a benefit we have that because it's internal for a company, we don't need to support any possible devices out there. It's just the specific Android tablets that we're targeting at a given time. So that helps kind of reduce the number of just kind of hardware variations. And on the flip side, our app also involves some hardware peripherals. And so when we're using it, like we can run in the emulator mode just when we're building out the user interface. But like there's a built-in reminder that we need to run on physical devices because we need to really connect to these real peripherals. So that has made it actually pretty easy for us on this project. But yeah, in other cases where you don't have an automatic need to run on the physical device, your reminder is really great that like you don't know what you don't know. Like you don't know what's going to differ. One thing I was curious about, do you like which platform do you use for your personal phone? And have you found yourself trying to use the other platform in your day-to-day life just to get used to it more? Or do you purely use that other platform just for testing your apps?
Good question. Honestly, I use it to have like an old Android phone, which is Android 5, which is really old and with small screen size. And that was perfect for testing. Yeah, it crashes all the time, and I go to the error tracking tools to see what's wrong, etc. So especially with the memory lag issue, then I have an iOS phone, so I really spend a lot of time in the Android. So I know the user experience and the native feedback and stuff in the Android. And now with the iOS, which I really use from day to day, I know how to the new user experience in iOS and the native feedback, etc. So yeah, for me, I use them both, and I'm happy with the iOS. That's for sure. It's really good, the user experience. But having these two smartphones in my hand and testing in both of them, you can see the differences and the other errors that you may not found in the emulator.
Yeah, it's just another connecting to your previous theme there about building for both platforms. It's something not to put off. Like try to find ways to remind yourself weekly or before each build or release to try on both platforms, try on physical devices, so you don't end up in this waterfall type approach where, you know, you've tested and worked out the happy path this whole several months, and then right at the end, you're trying all the devices and all the hardware, and it's not going to be a happy experience.
Yeah, for us in Obytes, we do a different thing. We provide the client with the app every 2 weeks or a week. So we really have this weekly or monthly feedback on what's going on. And also when something is causing issues in the app, you can test it yourself in the real device and see where the problem is. Sometimes it's from giants, sometimes it's from a crash that happened, you didn't catch an error or something like that.
What do you use for error tracking?
I use Sentry for error tracking. It's really good. I'm happy with it. It gave me the right place and the right line where the error come from. Yeah, so I can debug it easily and see where the problem comes from.
Great. We're using Bugsnag on my current project. It's working great for us as well. I haven't done like a feature comparison between the two, but I think both of them have been at Team React conference, and I've gotten swag from both of them there. And so Sentry and Bugsnag are certainly both targeting the React Native community. And I think the CEO or founder of Bugsnag was on React Native Radio a few weeks ago talking about their product. But yeah, I think both of those would be great to check out.
Yeah, yeah, I will check the one that you're using. I've never heard that before, to be honest.
You mentioned something about Android app sign-in and the Keystore file. What is there to know about that topic?
Yeah, just small reminder, because I came across a team that loses his Keystore and the application was in the Play Store. So if you know the Keystore file, you use the Keystore file in order to push your app to the Play Store. So if you lost the Keystore file, you can never regenerate a new Keystore and push the same application to the same one in the Play Store. So basically, you will lose all the users that are in the Play Store. So the only solution you have is to generate a new Keystore and push the application as a new application in the Play Store. But Android, even if you deleted the last app, Android can reject your app and tell you that they're already the same app in the store. So just be careful to and make sure to have a backup of the Keystore file in some place that you can go and find it. So yeah, that's an important tip, because I have come across a team that loses and he's paying for it right now.
That's a great tip. A lot of these problems you can undo, but this is one that you can't undo. And so it's great to let folks know about, especially folks like me that have done iOS development, but not Android development natively. So that's helpful.
Yeah. And by the way, I really like the iOS for in this area, because you don't bother yourself with those certificates, because you can download it from the store whatever you want, not like Android.
Yeah, they've been making that more and more automatic over the years, and so it's nice to say, hey, just solve that for me, please. And even if it's not perfect, at least it's trying.
Yeah. One more thing I want to talk about is the continuous integration and continuous delivery. So when you want to release an app in iOS and Android, it will really take your time if you do it manually in Xcode or Android Studio. So doing using the continuous integration, continuous delivery will not cost you a lot of time, and it will be easier for the team to deliver the app. So I'm gonna just guide you through the stack that I'm using. For the environment build and deployment track management, we use Fastlane. Fastlane is a great tool, especially for iOS and certificates generation. So it's really a nightmare when you have a problem in your local machine with your certificates. So Fastlane fixes that for you. So also, when you have a big team, Fastlane will help you having one certificate for all of the team, which will be in a private repository. So everyone can put it and just release the app. For the continuous integration, we're using CircleCI. We are happy with it, but there is a downside for it. There is no free plan for the macOS and iOS release. So for the staging app deployment, we're using App Center, we are happy with it right now. It's really easy to integrate in React Native. It's also have this code push. I don't know if you use it, Josh, the code push in the App Center.
Yeah, I haven't used it yet, but I'm very excited to someday. It's one of my, that possibility is one of my favorite things about the React Native architecture.
Yeah. For the code push, for the guys who don't know what is code push, allow you to push changes directly to the user device without going through the Play Store. So if you close the app and reopen it again, he will find a new update. So that's really a cool thing to have. For the product app deployment, we're using App Store Connect and the Google Play Console. So basically the workflow is this. We have the QA, which we are delivering to the clients via App Center. And then we have the production that we use in App Center and connect us to the Play Store. So App Center have this cool thing that you can connect your App Center to your Play Store. So basically, you can, if the staging was okay in your App Center, you can just do another build like to the master, or I don't know which is your workflow. But for example, to the master, it will connect to the Play Store and push the last release to the production or the beta release in your Play Store. So try to automate your release wherever you can, because it's really helpful. It's really gonna not lose time in your development anymore if you automate your release, especially in Xcode. I heard in the React Native video one time that some guy have uninstalled the Xcode and installed it again just to make a release.
Wow, yeah, that's rough. That's a lot of gigabytes of reinstalling, yeah. That's for sure.
Yeah, so just use Fastlane, it's a lifesaver for me.
Yeah, I mean, and getting all these things set up can certainly be overwhelming for new developers on these platforms. And so, you know, hey, you're doing a hobby project, or it's like a proof of concept for the very first time. It's like, sure, do it by hand. Like, that's fine. But maybe, or you may want to go ahead with Fastlane to see what it automates, to see if it helps you there. But yeah, like once you've got it out there, like your app is you know, pushed up, like your first beta build or something like that, putting this automation in place is super, super useful. If nothing else, like, I mean, listeners know how much I'm in favor of automated testing. And so like all of my projects, like I will definitely set up automated tests to run on pull requests that are up there. It's like at least to get that safety, if nothing else, that also allows me to update the dependencies and make sure that my app is still running. But yeah, for the release process as well, like it's just not, yes, it might take you a few hours to set up that automation, but like think about the lifetime of your app. Like unless it's a hackathon, it's going to be around for a while and it's going to pay off the time savings. The ability to onboard new team members, the ability to do releases when the lead developer is out. There's so many things about that kind of automation and kind of encoding your processes in code. It just pays off so much.
Yeah, totally agree with you. What do you use for testing in your apps?
I use React Native Testing Library for component tests. Although our client project is on Enzyme for our component tests, and that's mostly working well. There's something we just came across where we're thinking about. Use effect hooks, actually. We're thinking about switching to React Native Testing Library because it will execute use effect hooks as we're starting to migrate the code base over to React hooks. And then for end-to-end testing, I tend to use Detox.
Yeah, Detox is a great tool. Detox is a great tool, for sure.
Do you have, this is very timely because I just today started looking into, I do a workshop on React and testing at Chain React, and it's just been announced actually that I'm coming back this next summer. So I'm very excited about that. And we didn't talk about continuous integration last year, but this year I want to get it in and to get it set up. So I was just working on getting my Detox test set up and running on the different CI services. So so you mentioned Circle CI. Like, do you what kind of component test and end-to-end test do you have running on Circle CI?
For now, we don't use end-to-end testing or any kind of test in the Circle CI. We didn't set up that yet, but we definitely will go with Detox and maybe Jest for testing also. So that's the stack in Obytes. We're using Jest and Detox. So we're kind of looking out for the best solution for it. But for now, it's Jest and Detox for them. Especially Detox works very well with the React Native Navigation. I don't know who's behind that. Maybe it's Wix, no?
Yeah, Wix creates both React Native Navigation and Detox. And so Detox, it makes sense that they would work well together.
Yeah.
One point I'll make to folks, you mentioned how Circle CI doesn't have a free plan for iOS. Travis CI is another CI solution. I've used Circle more in the past, but Travis does have free plans for open source projects. And most of my hobby projects, even my kind of side projects, are all open source. And so that's a big benefit to me. And so I imagine I'm probably going to switch my personal React Native work over to Travis CI because of that. Initially, I'm kind of trying out GitHub Actions as well. And as of right now, I'm able to get an iOS build running with Detox on there just fine. I need to dig into, I don't know what billing setup GitHub has or is going to have in the future. I know they don't have my credit card number, so they're not going to be billing me anything unless unless there's some Microsoft crosstalk in the back in there or something like that. But yeah, I know that the Travis says and guarantees and has had free plans for open source for a long, long time. So there's certainly a safe bet if your app is open source or available publicly. And I just was able to confirm Detox itself, their own test suite, runs on Travis. And so they will be well supported in the future, I think.
Yeah, yeah, I will definitely try Travis. It's the first time I hear of it. If it's have like free plan for iOS, it's would be really good for personal projects. Yeah. Yeah, I'm going to try it out. Thanks.
Cool. Are there any other topics you wanted to get to or things you wanted to share before we go to picks?
One last thing. I really encourage people to try to learn React Native and especially the React Native CLI, because a lot of folks say that if you first time with React Native, just go with Expo and it would be easier for you. I don't buy that. I really like digging into the errors and figuring out. So yeah, it would be a lot of fun and just try it out. I remember when my first time doing React Native init, it took me more than 2 days to edit the project. Yeah, for unknown reason, unknown error. But from that time, I really had this patience of any error can be solved and just be patient and try React Native. It's really gonna pick you out, gonna pay out in the finish line. That's for sure. React Native is the revolution of cross-platform apps. So just make sure to give it a shot and good luck with it. That's
absolutely.
Yeah.
Cool. Let's go to picks. I have a few for this week and then you can share. I've mentioned it from time to time, and I'm going to try not to mention it every week, but I want to talk about the Big Nerd Ranch guides. So I work at Big Nerd Ranch. We're a consultancy, and so we will build your web or native or React Native app for you. But we also do trainings on boot camps on iOS and Android, and we publish guides as well, books on iOS and Android. They're very well thought of, and I can say that because I didn't work on them myself. It's other people that I work with that are great teachers and writers that have done that. And I really encourage them, especially for React Native developers, to do the kind of things that you were talking about, Yasser, to get underneath the hood, to understand a bit more about what's happening natively. And so, you know, there's the Intro to iOS book and the Intro to Android book. And I would encourage folks to check it out if you're a React Native developer, not because you're going to be using everything in there all the time, but it'll get you used to Xcode or Android Studio. It'll get you used to things like setting up your application icon and doing publishing, you know, and things like that. And so the things that are outside of the JavaScript layer, outside of the React layer, these guides will really help kind of close the gap and get you some native skills. And that's especially helpful if you're on a smaller team or you don't have a native developer available. The guides can really help you level up.
Yeah.
The other library I want to talk about is PouchDB, which is a database library that's built for offline and synchronizing use. It's been around for a number of years. JavaScript Jabber podcast had an interview back in 2015, I think, with one of the maintainers of PouchDB. But the reason I ended up there was I have a number of apps, especially for React Native, that are kind of utility focused. Like it's kind of like it's my personal data. Right now I'm working on a to-do app because I'm being very stereotypical. And so I've actually decided that I don't need to share data to other people. I don't actually need the data to be in a relational database or anything like that. But really what I need more than anything else is it would be great if my app, even if I'm offline, I can just edit and add and delete to-dos. And I just know that when I go back online, that everything's going to synchronize up and be good to go. And when I pull up the app and the web version of it, that it accesses as well. And so I was looking in a lot of different solutions. I mentioned Orbit.js a few weeks ago on the podcast. But when it came to it in the end, I finally was able to convince myself, hey, you know, PouchDB is the JavaScript library, and it uses the CouchDB, starting with a C, CouchDB protocol with CouchDB database running on the server side. And it's a protocol that's been designed for the ground up for synchronizing. So it handles all of that for you. It's really abstracts it away. And there's cases where data can conflict because, you know, you could make two different conflicting changes while you're offline. So that's unavoidable. And CouchDB has facilities for handling that. But for most cases, most of the time, it really makes it seamless. And so I finally convinced myself to try it, even though I'm an old, you know, Rails relational database guy. But I finally realized that this was really the solution that was going to be best for this application. And there's React Native support as well. So I'll put links in the show notes to PouchDB itself. And then PouchDB React Native is a library that sets up the data to be stored using async storage. So, you know, the React Native's or React Native community's option for storing data locally. And just in the last few days of getting it going, it's been really seamless and worked really well. I'm glad to have this running on my side project so I can see if there are headaches or problems or issues. You know, if there's a data issue down the road, it's just my personal to-do, so it's okay. But yeah, I've been really excited to do it. And it seems like, you know, if you want, if that offline access and that synchronizing is your biggest need, then going with PouchDB and CouchDB may be the way to go if you have the ability to, if the business is good with it. And, you know, any problems that might come up because the data is not relational, for example, then those might be the right problems to solve, because building synchronizing yourself can be extremely hard and extremely error prone. So I would encourage folks to check out PouchDB. It's open source, and CouchDB is as well. So unlike something like Google Firebase, you're not locked into a proprietary system. You can still own your data. Your data lives on your servers if you want. So yeah. Yasser, how about you? What picks do you have?
Maybe a couple of books people to read beside the development industry. The first book, it's Deep Work. I don't know if you have read it, Josh.
I've heard about it, but I haven't read it.
Yeah, it's an awesome book. It's an awesome book. So to summarize the Deep Work, is Deep Work guide you to concentrate more and accomplish more things with less time. So this idea of accomplishing more things in less time, or learning more things in less time, that's really key changing in every industry. So concentration is not easy. It's like sleep. If someone interrupts you in the third phase of your sleep, you're gonna just begin from the first phase. You cannot go back in from the third phase and sleep. That's the same thing for concentration. That's the first one, the Deep Work. And now I'm reading the 4-Hour Work Week. Yeah, it's really good. I enjoy reading it. But yeah, I really encourage people to read that as well, as he's really, really a successful book and really a famous one. So yeah, that's the two books for me, for my picks.
Those are great. Deep Work in particular, I think I need to check that out. I say that I'm a really good multitasker, but I also acknowledge that, like, science disagrees that humans are not good multitaskers. And so I think it's sort of an illusion, and I guess I'm doing well enough now, but like, I'd love to check out Deep Work to see how things could be going better. Like, what am I missing, and how could my work or productivity be more effective by really concentrating? So I'm excited to check that out.
Yeah. Just check it out. It's a really good book. Also, it's really good for encouraging people to work in remotely. Also, do you work remotely, Josh?
I sure do. Yeah, our offices are elsewhere in Atlanta, but it's over a drive away from me. And so most of the time I'm working remotely from home. And I love it. And I wish more companies made that option available, because I think it helps people's quality of life.
We have the same culture for us in Obama's. Yeah, people can work from home or come to the office. So it's really, I think you can accomplish more if you work from home than from the office, not having colleagues interrupting you all the time. So yeah, Deep Work encourage people to work remotely. So yeah, it's highly recommended. Just check it out. You will thank me later.
Cool. Well, Yasser, thank you so much for joining. These are great tips. I think it's going to be really helpful to folks. So, you know, listeners, just check out one of those two things, kind of dive in deep and help get yourself equipped. But Yasser, we're really glad you joined us this week. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Josh. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. And listeners, thanks a lot. And we'll catch you next time for another episode of React Native Radio. See ya.
Bandwidth for this segment is provided by CacheFly, the world's fastest CDN. Deliver your content fast with CacheFly. Visit CacheFly.com to learn more.